Hello, this is Pixelated Playgrounds, a gaming book club podcast discussing the art and craft of video games. I'm Brian Skirsha.
And I'm Josh Galecki. And today we're talking about Jusson. Developed and published by Don't Nod, this game was released for Windows, PlayStation 5, Xbox Series XS on October 31st, 2023. And we'll be talking spoilers here, so heads up if you're sensitive to that.
Yes, indeed. And this is a game that I would say is fairly light on that sort of storytelling, but it does a good amount of environmental storytelling. And yeah, there's an ending that you'll want to see. I feel like this is a pretty neat, uplifting game.
I don't feel this game had a lot of... It wasn't something where the twist was what was selling it, you know?
Exactly, yeah. You're here for the atmosphere. You're here for the journey, the climb, if you will.
But yeah, that's really interesting because both of us picked up this game independently, if I understand it.
Yeah, that's right. So I heard lots of glowing praise for this game. It came onto Game Pass, which is always a good reason to check out a game when you're already having paid for it, I suppose, via subscription. So yeah, popped into my library. I heard enough people saying wonderful things and decided to play it. And simultaneously... Josh did.
yeah, from my Twitter friends and whatnot. I heard enough people talking good things about it that I'm like, oh, I'll check it out. The premise is really intriguing, because how many games are climbing games?
Yeah, that's true. I know two, and I loved them, and I think I told you guys about them back in the day, but I never really heard many people talk about them. I'm talking, of course, about the Ubisoft Spotlight titles, Grow Up and Grow Home. Which basically this game wholesale rips off the left trigger, right trigger climbing mechanic from. Not to say that's a bad thing. I think more games should utilize that.
Well, I mean, you know, other games also use the joystick for movement too. I feel like
that's true. Yeah,
are older games. Like this isn't like stealing someone's thunder here.
Oh no, absolutely. This is one of those things that like I'm happy to see embraced again, you know, more tactile feeling of climbing. I feel like games have been in this rut of what climbing is thanks to the games such as Assassin's Creed. And I enjoy an Assassin's Creed, don't get me wrong, but you're not exactly getting the feel of actually climbing very much when you're like vaulting up the side of the Eiffel Tower or what have you.
Oh, for sure. Well, I mean, we'll get into this, but I feel like Assassin's Creed kind of had a parkour puzzle aspect to it. Same thing with Breath of the Wild too, and this was very, very different.
Yeah, definitely. Much more considered. We'll definitely talk more about the mechanics in depth, but perhaps we should talk a little bit about the developer first. Don't Nod, who you mentioned up top, is a French studio who is, for my money, best known for Life is Strange, which I have not played, but as I understand is much more focused on its storytelling and its narrative than this game, which is clearly focused on its mechanics and, I guess, its environment.
Same here. This is not a studio I'm familiar with. I've heard of Life is Strange, but have not played it. I have not heard of any of their other titles.
Yeah, same here. So we can basically come into this blank slate. You know, we are experiencing a Don't Nod game for the first time. And so far, I like it. I'm willing to check out other stuff thanks to the endorsement that I am about to give of Jusson.
Mm-hmm. And what a game it is, too.
Yeah, definitely. So striking right off the bat, you know, you are walking up to this gigantic monolithic rock tower through a desert littered with boats. So clearly water used to be here. Jusson is worth, it's worth mentioning, is a French nautical term for the receding tide.
For those of you who never took French, or like me who took French 2 decades ago and remembered nothing, certainly not nautical terms, they do have an epigram at the beginning of the game explaining this. And this is before you see anything, so you're like, oh, what does Jusson mean? I thought it was just a fancy made-up word. No, it actually means something. And then you see, like, okay, receding tide, and the plot opens up with you walking through a desert with boats on it, and you arrive at what I call the tower.
Yeah, I think everyone calls it the tower. But yeah, you are a kid with tattoos, so you know he's important. and he has a little blue guy in his backpack, this little blue blob. And he has, for some reason, decided to journey to this tower through the desert and sets about climbing it.
Well, that's kind of funny because I pictured this as a girl in my playthrough.
Interesting. Yeah. I think they're kind of non-gendered. We can just call it the climber.
The climber, or yeah. He, she, you know, whatever your headcanon is here.
The climber, yeah. Be it he or she or they, the climber is there to, I guess, ascend the tower and blow some horns. You are here kind of wondering right off the bat a few very simple questions. What happened to everyone? Where did the water go? And why are we here?
And what is this little blue guy that's hanging around in my bag? Because they are adorable.
Yeah, they really are. The little blue guy is, they need a plushie of that, like ASAP, just for people in there. And we find out very quickly that it's called a ballast. So the spoiler warning is off here. But this is a baby ballast that you are carrying in your bag.
Did you find that out pretty early? I might have missed some letters along the way. Like, I eventually made the connection like, oh, I have a baby ballast over here. I think not until I saw the first ballast, though.
I think I realized it when I saw a mural.
Okay.
It was, yeah, like maybe not an early mural. Maybe I'm overestimating how early this was put together for me. But at any rate, this isn't a long game. You know, the
yeah,
whole thing
like
is
5 hours.
5 hours. So early on for a long game's perspective, I suppose. the interesting thing about this game, aside from its mechanics, of course, is sort of the exploration you're doing of this tower and the extremely striking visuals that it's bringing. You know, I don't know, again, a lot about this studio, but to me, this is like a graphical or artistic, rather, tour de force. Like the lighting and textures, or lack of textures, I suppose, everything is pretty flat and cel-shaded here, is really a striking look.
Oh, absolutely. The look is really good, and the world is just a pleasure to walk around and explore. Like, I think it's actually fairly highly detailed, or at least in a sort of, like, that first level when you're going through the, maybe the most populated part of it, or one of the most populated levels, just the clutter and the stuff over there, this world looked more lived in than I think a lot of other towns that I've had the pleasure of walking through. Cough, cough, Skyrim.
Yeah, I mean, we're here a solid decade plus after Skyrim, and asset generation technology is just way off the charts from where it's been. But I hear you.
That is true.
To the point that I think they are able to utilize that very effectively with how they're staging things, because the clutter is absolutely intentional with the base of this tower, because what you'll find out as you journey from the top or the bottom to the top is that people were migrating downward slowly as the water was moving away. So you get the sense that, you know, people are deciding to leave. They're congregating at the base of the towers. The tide is going out as jouissance is taking place, if you will. I don't know if that's a correct grammatical use of that, but I don't care.
I'm American. No, that's fair enough. Yeah, you hear about a lot of this through stories, through these kind of like notes and letters you find along the way. People writing their pen pals on different parts of the tower. And you hear about these migrations, people heading out into the desert because there's no water left over here. So the entire tower that you're climbing this whole time, completely depopulated. You don't see another soul the entire time you're there.
Yeah, and it allows the game to do a lot of more contemplative things with its storytelling, or how it chooses to do two things: portray its environment and tell its story. And to that regard, the game, as you mentioned, Josh, has no dialogue and therefore relies entirely on the environment to tell its story. We've already talked about how it uses its stage setting for that, but they also do a lot of things with letters, notes, journals, you know, basically found footage in terms of writing. The only thing I didn't love about this is there's no VO, and I really would have loved to hear like a little audio log to play as I explore. Somehow games always seem to screw this up from my perspective. Either there's no VO or only VO if you stay in the menu. Just let it play in the background as I continue, please, for the love of God.
Was there any voiceover for this one? I don't think there
was. No, but there was not. But what I'm saying is, like, no game seems to get this exactly right. Like, if there's audio logs, you have to sit in a menu and stare at the words while it reads it to you. Like, just someone, please, let it play like a podcast and let me walk while I listen.
I hear you, and I agree with that in general. I think in this particular game, the lack of voices served a particular function to make it feel more abandoned. You're finding evidence of people who used to live here rather than people there and talking right now.
I agree with that, and that was more of a general complaint than a complaint about this game, to be fair. I agree that, like, the silence here is powerful, and it is underscored by another storytelling tool that this game has in its tool belt, which is the seashells.
Loved this. Like, the notes and the letters, the found narrative kind of stuff, that's been done in a, you know, 100 other games in the last couple of years, just alone. But the seashells were a very unique sort of thing. What would happen is you walk up, you find a seashell, you push a button, and it gives you a small cutscene of just the area you're around. You're not even in the cutscene yourself. It's just you listening to the shell and listening to the echoes of what happened before.
Yeah, it's almost as if the seashell absorbed the sounds of the environment over time and is slowly playing them back to you long past the times when they were active. It's really interesting. It recontextualizes these abandoned spaces as ones that were once full of life. And, you know, if this game's soundtrack wasn't already doing it for you, which it should have been, by the way, it's fantastic. We'll talk more about that later. But the sound that these seashells bring and the life that they impart on the now abandoned areas that you're exploring is really something to behold.
Yeah, it plays some audio. Like, I think there's a couple times you hear, like, water flowing or children playing in the background beyond a general seashell echo kind of thing going on. There was a really nice note you found before the first seashell about how someone had a collection of these and how, you know, this person was doing a chore for this person, which was just listening to the seashells, because the seashells also miss the ocean, which is it lent a very kind of like, not nostalgic, or maybe like hardcore nostalgic feeling to it.
Yeah, like the true meaning of nostalgia. Longing, the pain from an old wound, to quote the Mad Men episode that I've referenced in the past. This game does a variety of different things to tell its story in this regard, and I think the seashells for me were some of the more affecting ones. There's also, as I already mentioned earlier, the frescoes that you'll find as you traverse up the tower, which tell sort of a prophecy or at least some history about the ballasts and how they interact with the tower.
I really appreciated these because you show up and you use your baby whale superpower or ability, and it makes them look really pretty, which this game has a great job of just making things look pretty.
Sure does. And while we're talking about the baby whales and their power, the baby ballast, if you will.
So talking about that baby whale power, you learn that if you push up on the D-pad, it sends out this ring of blue around you that has some various effects on the world. But you first learn this during one of the horn-blowing sequences that Brian mentioned earlier. And I thought these were really cool storytelling technique, especially I think the first one really set it up for me. You are walking through this desert, you are climbing up, and you blow this horn. I'm expecting some sci-fi stuff to happen, and there's a little bit of that, but there's also all these green plants popping up and sprouting out all around me, which instantly tells you what you're doing. There's a desert, I'm here to save it. I'm here to undesert it.
Yeah, you're greening the place. And, you know, well, we should definitely talk more about some of this game's themes and such as we perhaps talk about the ending a little later. But for now, let's talk a bit about the climb. As you mentioned, pretty early on, you get this power or you have this scene where you're introduced to the power of the little ballast that you're toting around. But our protagonist also has powers of their own. And those powers are, they are a hella good rock climber.
Oh, man. Like, the finger strength.
I know, right?
Some of these grips. My goodness.
Yeah. As someone who dabbled in rock climbing for fun on a pretty regular basis back in college and shortly thereafter. This is just absurd.
Damn.
What this kid is doing. But it is really fun. And as we talked about, like, this is a mechanic that I think more games should take advantage of. Like, climbing is something that happens in almost every game. I mean, when I think about, like, you know, right now I'm playing, for example, Star Wars Jedi Survivor. One of the main things that protagonist does is he climbs like a mofo. As I understand it, you're Nathan Drake's of the world, big climbing guys. Also, all of the assassins of the Assassin's Creed. Climbing is a common video game verb, but I've rarely seen it explored in the way that this game does it.
Yeah, it's a lot of the time, the games I've played, climbing has been like a press A here and point yourself in this direction. Like, it's a sort of
it's on autopilot.
Platforming. It's a vertical platforming sort of thing. Or it's on autopilot, too, and it's just kind of elided over. This game really makes you feel the climbing because, like you mentioned earlier, the L button is your left hand and the R button is your right hand. And if you aren't holding down to one of those, your character lets go and just falls. Sometimes you want to do that.
Yeah, sometimes you want to do that. And what you'll find yourself doing as a result of this mechanic is you'll be charting out routes, identifying useful handholds for your left or right hands. You know, handholds being the surfaces of the cliff you can actually grab onto. And you'll manage your stamina mid-climb by, like, shaking off the pump on your arms, which is a relatable thing for anyone who's spent a long time, you know, tensing up and trying to climb and then realizing that your arms fatigue faster when you have all that blood flowing through like that, so you need to shake them out. On top of that, there are sort of other rock climbing nomenclatures and things going on in this game. You have pinions and belays. You know, you have this sort of ability to, during a climb, well, I guess when you start off a climb, you set your
sci-fi
anchor point.
Rope.
Yeah, your sci-fi rope, which is as an anchor point, because this game, generously, will never let you fling yourself off the tower and fall to your death. This is a no-failure state game. So what it does is allow you to do some self-selecting checkpointing after you begin a climb, and that is through the belays in the form of three different pinions that you can put into the wall at any given point.
You can add those in, you can take them out if you head back to them. You have a limited amount of rope, so there were a few times where I actually did have to backtrack and take out an old pinion because I couldn't reach the next platform with the amount of rope I had left. Especially because that rope, you know, it's actual rope. It'll get caught on the 3D nature of these landscapes you're exploring sometimes. You're like, oh man, that tree branch was not counting on that when I factored out my route.
I really love that. I love how the rope physics in this game are really good. Like, you know, the only other game I've played with more true-to-life rope mechanics, and this is... they are not actually as good as this game in the other game about to mention, is The Last of Us Part 2. And that game had a way bigger budget than this one. So I think this is just something that's improved over time. One other thing I liked about that rope is the color changed on it as an indicator of the range you have left. It starts off blue and trends towards yellow, then red. I think that was a really elegant design decision to tell you about how much rope you got left in your little magic sack of rope.
Didn't really notice that one myself, but it is a nice little cue they do.
Yeah, for sure. So to your point about sort of the physics and the way this rope allows you to interact with the environment that you're climbing up, we mentioned the ability to sort of set an anchor point and then just drop, just sort of let yourself dangle. And that opens up the possibility for swinging. And not only swinging, but running along the side of the cliff back and forth and back and forth until you build up enough momentum to, say, perhaps fling yourself off and hopefully grab onto something before you plummet or whiplash yourself back over to where your anchor point was.
Mm-hmm. And like Brian said, there's not a failure state in this. In fact, there's really only one currency you spend. When you do a jump or a double jump, then that decreases the maximum amount of stamina you can recharge to until you get yourself on ground again. So you can explore things around, you can take your time doing things. Really is a lot more methodical, a lot more patient than normal video game climbing is, which makes sense because actual climbing is not flinging yourself up the side of a cliff as fast as you can.
It's true. You know, if you try to fling yourself up the side of a building like the assassins in Assassin's Creed do, you're probably going to meet yourself with a head injury pretty quickly.
That's why you need sci-fi rope.
Exactly, sci-fi rope. But to your point about stamina management, I think it's really interesting how this game, you know, starts off fairly simple with like one anchor point. You complete a climb and then you emerge onto the next platform and you explore a bit. Over the course of the game, you start to get a few different anchor points mid-climb where it'll restore your stamina and you're expected to continue on mid-climb without the aid of a platform. So what this allows you to do is, you know, one, you're treating those anchor points as like oases where you can sort of get your stamina back and you feel like a sense of relief as you reach them, which is really nice.
It's also a way to direct the player. You see one of those and you're like, okay, that's my next goal right there. Like, they have longer climbing sequences, but you're never really like unsure where you're supposed to be going, even with all the detailed terrain and everything around you, or the path, you know, goes around corners or something like that. You can, I think, pretty much always see the way you're supposed to go. In fact, I don't think when I was climbing I ever got lost. I only got lost in the game once, and that was when I was walking around the city, the cave city inside. But kudos to the game's level design for doing that. Like, this was a game that where it could have easily you know, been the thing where it's like, you need a map. You need a mini map right here to tell you where to go and a waypoint. And like, here's a little GPS trail for what your climbing route should be. And turns out if you have good enough level design and a linear game, you don't need any of that.
Yeah, I think this is a really important point. Like, there are side paths and like little hidden passages to discover and side content that'll, you know, maybe lead you to one of those murals or frescoes we talked about, or perhaps a correspondence or journal entry or letter or something. But there was never, to your point, there's no branching paths in this game, right? There's no alternate route up the mountain. And the level design keeps you from needing the types of affordances that perhaps some more complex games like that would need, as you mentioned, Josh. And I appreciated this. Like, to your point about slowing down and taking your time, that was the thing that I think I noticed most as I was playing this game and myself, was that I didn't feel the need to just fling myself up the side of the cliff as fast as humanly possible. You could take a minute and look around and notice things and not necessarily worry about, say, you know, your stamina depleting, except for certain cases, which we'll talk about. But interesting thing about that in this game, it's not as much of a go, go, go as you might expect from a climbing game.
I think an interesting kind of a corollary to that is that without as much UI, there's a lot, and without as much like, I need to look 2 miles up the tower and see what I'm going to do next. There's kind of a more immediacy to when you're playing the game. You're focused on like what's right around you and what the next handholds are going to be. You are, as you know, it's not like you're doing an obstacle course so much, kind of like older platformers and older climbing games might be. There's no puzzle to solve with the climbing, or at least none that you have to like have any sort of twitchiness at all to do.
That's probably the better way to put it, is there's no like sort of twitch sequence you need to necessarily you need to overcome for most of the game. It's more about like identifying the obstacles in your path and using the maneuvers and tools in your arsenal to afford that. And maybe we should talk a little bit about this, because we already talked about the little power that your ballast guy gets. But that works not only in the cutscenes, but also in the climbing environment, as there are several situations where you can use that little, I'll call it the water ring, sort of a blue ring that extends out from your character when you activate it, that causes the ballast to hydrate the surrounding area, and it can be used to grow vines or cause cliff flowers to bloom that can be used as handholds or climbing ladders, mm-hmm. if you will.
Yeah, these vines will take you to the next route, or sometimes they're like little ways to go and backtrack a little bit. And the cliff flowers, I call them, they're like little handholds that sprout out, and you can start climbing off in that direction too. Later on, you find these anti-gravity fireflies that you can summon and then do just a really tall jump over there, which I think that was fine, but I like the first two plant-based ones a little better.
Honestly, my favorite one is in the sun hot area, where the cliff flowers will wither away after a short amount of time, but it introduces a new option for handholds that you can use, which is the little rock grub bugs.
Oh, I loved those. That was my favorite mechanical twist in the game.
Me too. I love how every new chapter in this game sort of has these little twists that they iterate on from a climbing mechanic perspective. And this one is, to my money and to your point, my favorite. It's basically these little bugs that look like, you know, those ants that will like disguise themselves with a leaf and make it look like they're just a leaf. This is just that, but for a rock tower. Like, they just look like a little rock protruding from the tower. And
but you can use them as a handhold, yeah.
That's right. So basically, they're like a little elevator. It's really cool.
What's really interesting about it is what it introduces is a non-static element to your route calculations. Mm. Like, you can't look at a sequence then and say, oh, I'm going to be able to go this way. You kind of have to see where the rock grubs are going. Are they taking you in this direction or that direction? Sometimes they go both and you got to choose which way to go. But it does add an interesting twist to your typical mountain climbing here.
Yeah, I loved that. Like, mobile handholds is a really good like distillation of what they provide to the mechanics of the game. And it's just such a good environmental storytelling thing too, because what you start to realize as you're working your way through the game is this is a whole society that's built on the idea that everyone's a rock climber. So of course they're adapting to their surroundings, and what do the fauna in the area do? Well, they support that lifestyle, right? There are these little like rocks and fauna that, you know, are naturally supportive of the rock climbing way of life. Someone who made this game really fucking loves rock climbing.
it shows. One way that that shows very well, too, is the animation for the climbing. So good. Like, we talked about the controls, the basic R and L button. You push and hold the R button, and that's your right hand grabbing the rock. Then your left hand, you can use the joystick to point it in different ways. And then when you like a handhold, you hit the L button and let go of the R button, and then your character climbs that way. You can get into a good rhythm doing it, but what kind of struck me about what could be, this game could be done now where it couldn't have been done 10 years ago, was how smoothly the animation looked. Like, before, you know, your character has a certain number of animations or something like that. Like, they can do these sequences, they can jump up the wall in this way. And the way they did the animation for this is something a little bit different. It uses something called inverse kinematics. I don't know if you've heard of that term before. But the basic idea is, you know, when you and me walk, our foot makes contact with the ground and we push off of the foot to go in the way we want to do. When a early 2000s or 2010 video game character walks, they start moving and their feet slide over the ground. Like, the direction comes first, and then they try to fudge it with the animation so it doesn't look too bad.
The animation matches what the model was already predetermined to do.
Yeah, yeah, so that's why it looks like, you know, you're doing the wave dashing from Melee if you are trying to abuse it.
Or the Michael Jackson moonwalk.
There you go. But what you have with inverse kinematic animation is you say, I want to go in this direction. And then what the game does is it plants the foot first and then calculates how the body would move around that in order to get to the direction you're wanting to go. So I think Alan Wake 2 uses that. That might be a future podcast game as well. So when you're playing that, take a look. But it's something that's definitely a more modern technology and allows that kind of like, there's so many animation states over here. This could not have been frame by frame animated and still have had as much freedom as they did to just go in any direction with the rock climbing.
So what you're saying here is there was a extremely detailed model that they created and then applied this inverse kinematic animation paradigm to it in order to have it, for lack of a better word, generate all of the appropriate animations that are put to use in the game.
Yeah, yeah. I guarantee you that, you know, this was all artist-driven and everything, but they were not, I don't think they were, you know, doing the, moving the bones around by hand or the joints around by hand here. They were making sure it would look right, whatever algorithm they used to make things work, and they did a good job doing that because things look fantastic. But I think this is one of the things where this game did not exist a decade ago, mostly because of this.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. And that's a really interesting observation in terms of, you know, the evolution of tools over time, allowing something like this mechanic to exist where perhaps in the past we would have seen a more rudimentary climbing mechanic in its place. And I'm happy for it because the mechanical aspect here is, you know, surprisingly one of the things that I gravitated towards the most. I didn't expect it with a game sort of this, I guess, production level. I expected it to be more storytelling heavy. And while its story is great, I think the mechanics are just as great, honestly.
You really get into a sort of zone when you're doing some of these climbing sequences, where you're like, okay, here's where I'm going, and I see the exact path I need to take here. And you know, I found that I was climbing much faster at the end than I was at the beginning, just because I get the timing and the rhythm down, and you feel like yourself getting a little bit of progression doing that.
Yeah, well, I guess it's worth mentioning, if we're talking about sort of mechanical progression, that by the final chapters of the game, you're put under a little bit of time pressure with regards to how fast you do need to climb. I'm talking, of course, about Chapter 5, I think it is, where there are shifting wind patterns, and you need to quickly make your way up a cliff face while a certain phase of the wind gusts are happening.
Interesting how that felt different than the sunny side of the cliffs, where the cliff flowers would dry out if you waited too long. And I think that's because the winds were just happening and you'd have to wait for your part of the cycle to jump through, whereas the dry flowers, or the drying out flowers, was kind of like user-started or user-initiated with your super water powers.
Yeah, that's a good point. We're talking, it takes it out of your control as compared to that earlier chapter.
But also good that they did the user-initiated timing challenge earlier than the cycle one, the cycle-based ones with the wins, because the latter is the harder one, so give the player some more experience first.
So as we talked about, you know, we have been progressing up the tower, dealing with increasingly harsh situations and environmental challenges that the weather and environments of the tower are throwing at us. You know, earlier on those lower levels, it's all docks and farming. The water sustains the tower sustains us all. The middle level, we're learning about how that water is distributed through great sluices. And then at the upper levels in the heights, where the wind is fierce, we finally end up meeting one of the remaining ballasts. The journey that we have embarked on a few hours ago is starting to come to its conclusion.
There was a really nice series of notes and letters from a girl named Bianca, who is taking a journey up to the top of the mountain while other people were going down the mountain and migrating down and out. And they were trying to capture a ballast, I think, and bring it back to restore the water to the thing. They were kind of, you know, everyone said they were crazy, ballasts don't actually exist, and turns out they did. But there was a nice moment where she's like, I realized what we were doing was terrible, and I threw everyone's harpoons away, and now I just live up here. And there's one ballast that I chill with every once in a while.
Yeah, and that chill ballast eventually ends up befriending our protagonist and his little friend Ballast Blob as well. And they make their way up and up and up and finally to the top of the tower where the game reaches its conclusion in a chapter number 6 called Syzygy, which is the peak of the
tower.
How
many Ys in that?
Three? Three. Let's call it three.
Seems excessive.
But yeah, it is a bit excessive, and it is also very high up, and everything is frozen. So what we've seen here is all of the ballast, including the one that just transported you up to the top of the tower, is frozen solid. It joins the rest of its kind dead, or seemingly so, near a large monolith in the center of a gigantic crater at the top of this tower, covered in ice.
The tower within a tower, and of course, what have you been doing but climbing towers this whole time? So you head down the crater and head up the tower.
Yeah, what do you do with a nail when all you've got is hammers? You climb that thing. So you climb the tower. Eventually, you are able to find, with the help of your little ballast companion, the ability to resuscitate all the ballasts. And the game ends as the first drops of water begin to fall from the sky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was a really nice ending. I thought it ended at a really good time. If it tried to go a little bit farther, I think that could have been a bit, I don't know, the game staked so much on being such a solitary journey. You don't meet anyone there. If they showed people coming back to the tower, which I think gets implied, if there's anybody left. I think the game ended at a good place. You journeyed to restore life, greenery, restore the water, and that happened.
Yeah, it's a game that's sort of about striving, climbing out of desolation to restore life. And I think all of the various correspondences and notes and journals that you find along the way highlight a couple things. One is how people face adversity and change. It's pretty interesting that this game kind of is a meditation on climate change. We've seen a few of these this year. I think it's going to continue to be a trend. Surprise, surprise. And it's really interesting here that, you know, we start to see things about people taking up the professions of their forebears and realizing that just doesn't seem to work in the situation these days. Relatable. Situations change and you can't make a good living raising the little pebble rock guys anymore because no one's using them. You can't have your farm when there's no water coming in as you'd expect it to. So it's definitely a game that is treading pretty heavily in that, climate change field there.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the types of climate change going on in that world and our own world are very different. You know, our oceans totally aren't disappearing, but, you know, things aren't necessarily...
They're rising.
But yeah, I think it talks about, without calling it out by name, but the kind of the refugee impact of climate change. People's livelihoods are changing. They aren't able to grow food anymore. You gotta move. And people doing that. I think this game had a optimistic view about things because there wasn't really conflict about that ever portrayed in the game. Everyone was more or less trying to help each other out. But interesting perspective, I think.
It's an interesting question about what gets people to leave or, you know, depart the place that they live or grow up. You know, both of us are, you know, neither of us live in the same neighborhood we grew up in. You live across town. I live in a different city in the same state. There are lots of people in our generation that live in completely different states or even countries from where they grew up. And there's lots of different reasons to leave, right? So I think that's an interesting thing this game is exploring too, right? Why do people leave? Why do people change their way of life?
And conversely, why do people stay behind?
Yeah, absolutely. There is actually a contingent in this game that is intent on seeing it through or thinks, you know, perhaps things will turn around. And I guess you are proof in the pudding that that does happen in one way or another, although I doubt things will ever be the same.
Human nature is a funny thing. Do you know about the trash dump fires in Centralia, Pennsylvania?
Yeah, I'm aware of that terrible, terrible story.
Yeah, they've been going on for 50 years or I don't know, something like that.
It's a coal mine fire, right?
It was a coal mine that, you know, wasn't depleted of coal that people dumped trash into. So it's trash and coal burning. There's still 5 or 6 people living there, I think.
Yeah, and obviously to great detriment of health, but, you know, it's pretty hard to get people to change their ways if they've, you know, grown up and lived somewhere their whole life. Mm-hmm. And I think it speaks to the naivete of people that think that they can just, create policy that is going to rip people away from their way of life without giving just accommodations for how you can expect people to survive when their entire way of life is expected to change, you know?
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
But all that is to say, you know, we have climbed the tower, we have changed the state. We don't get to see how things work afterwards, which, as you said, I think is a pretty solid... It is an interesting move from a storytelling perspective, but to your point, I think I kind of prefer it being open-ended in that regard.
I think an interesting thing, too, is the Karens that you can find in Addestone, too. Sometimes you go down a long side path, only to find that you... the thing at the end is a small pile of stones that you can add another stone to. This is, I don't know about the climbing community, but in the outdoors community, this is kind of like a thing people do. But it's, to me, it kind of spoke to this kind of dependence on or recognition of everything that came before you, to keeping balance when everything else is around there, to making your mark saying, I was here, even by just, you know, small stack of stones or something like that. But also like acknowledging everyone else that was there before you too, in that act of putting a small stone on a cairn. And I think that was a powerful thing, a very optimistic thing as you're climbing up. You don't know what you're going to be doing. You don't know if you'll be successful or not, but you leave, a small physical evidence of your presence there, that you did this, you tried it out, and that you are in some way in sync with these other people putting stones there.
Yeah, you're in conversation with the other folks that may have tried to ascend or descend the tower before you. The Karens are a really nice memento of the passing of a whole bunch of different people, and your character is just the latest in a long line of travelers.
An interesting thing to point out, too, is that this is the only interaction in the game where your character does something that has a permanent effect. Like, you go through these towns and you read letters. I suppose you blow the horns and bring some grass around, which is kind of, like, cool, too.
But permanent desk.
None of the other things you do in the game, like, leave a trace that you existed.
Hmm. Yeah,
all the climbing, it was there, it's gone. Your sci-fi rope travels with you.
Yeah, all of your pinions as well. The magical pinions somehow Iron Man back to your back at some point. But yeah, it's that's a good point. I never really thought about that as being sort of your soul memento you're leaving behind. And it's kind of nice. It echoes a real life, you know, when you're hiking and you stumble across a cairn and put a rock on the top of the tower or the top of the pile there. That is one of the only things you can do in, say, a national park to say, I was here. Because, as we all know, you are supposed to take only pictures and leave only footprints.
Absolutely.
Speaking of taking only pictures, I think the mental picture that I have most strongly in my brain from this game is not a picture at all, but it is the soundtrack. It's just continuously playing that gorgeous, beautiful leitmotif that this game has in its soundtrack that continuously plays in sort of moments of heightened drama or especially beautiful moments. The soundtrack in this game is suitably majestic. It's driving, it's somber, it's beautiful, all of the above at times where it's most needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's definitely the moments in the game where, like, this is a game that stops to smell the roses, whether you're holding up a seashell to your ear and just being where you are for 10 seconds or 20 seconds, or you're climbing up and you have this majestic vista going on there. The game is definitely not afraid to use the soundtrack to reinforce that feeling of, drive up, heighten the emotion, or let you chill out, or just take in what you see around there. I remember some piano pieces, I think, in the dry level, the sunny level, and the caves level, that I just stopped to listen to. Like, I don't do that often with a soundtrack where I just stop and listen to the music.
I think that was one of the things about this game that was most Journey-esque for me. Obviously, Austin Wintry, I believe, was the composer for that game and a few other notable soundtracks that are also stop and listen worthy. And this game is no different. It's just to your point, like, you are sometimes just compelled to listen and absorb the moment, in part due to the soundtrack, in part due to the stunning visuals and the vistas that this game affords, and in part just because you need to rest after a long climb.
Well, sure, you get to the top of a long sequence and you you look around. You're looking to see what you are going to do next. You're looking at paths for the next climbing leg, maybe. And you're taking in the music while you do it. The composer, Guillaume Ferron, apologies for my pronunciation, is first-rate composer for sure.
Yeah, totally agree with you there. Deserves all the credit in the world for the amazing work in Jusson, and I hope to listen to many more of their soundtracks in the future. As we look to complete our climb up the heights of Jusson's tower, let us stop and contemplate our three-word reviews.
All right, my three-word review for Jusson is To New Heights. Jusson was first described to me as pure vibes, and it delivers. It aims high with its intriguing pitch of sci-fi climbing game, and it has the mechanical and narrative chops to validate that initial interest. In a year where Tears of the Kingdom was released, Jusson somehow pulls off having the most engaging climbing mechanics. The game has the confidence to let its world do the talking, even using ocean shells as a pacing break in order to show short cutscenes. Cutscenes of where you are in the immediate environment. The story unfolds at a good pace nonetheless, drawing the player in with world-building questions from the get-go and slowly unraveling the mystery of what happened in this apocalyptic world. I like games that try to break out of the mold, and I love it when those games succeed so well. Jusson takes the Pathfinder platformer to new heights.
Agreed. Great comparison on the Tears of the Kingdom, by the way. That's not one I would have thought to draw, but I totally agree. My three-word review is a lesson in patience. I'm not sure what I expected when I started Jusson, but what I got is a game that asks you to simply slow down and enjoy the climb. It rewards you for analyzing the situation in front of you, choosing your route and handholds, and then executing. The deliberateness of movement and the feeling of expression that the game's mechanics afford the player are one of Jusson's high points, and yet it does all of this despite the fact that you are always working towards the same goal, ever upward towards the summit. No branching paths or procedural generation, just a tower and a boy and his blob who need to climb it. On the way, you might take a minute to read some notes left behind. Their melancholy, seriousness, and sometimes levity piqued curiosity and spurred me steadily onward. Jusson strikes a deft balance between its core climbing mechanics and the quiet moments of reflection and awe its environments inspire. Yet, as I reached the summit, my head literally in the clouds, the thing I felt most keenly was thankfulness that Jusson had urged me to have the patience to slow down and enjoy my time climbing the tower away from the hustle and bustle of everyday life. And for that, Jusson gets two thumbs up from me, I think from both of us.
Absolutely.
And with that, we want to say thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed this podcast, then feel free to share it with folks you think might enjoy it as well. And if you want to get in touch, drop us a note at pixelatedplaygrounds@gmail.com or contact us on @Twitter @PixelPlayPod. And for us here at Pixelated Playgrounds, I'm Brian Skirsha.
I'm Josh Galecki.
Take care and keep on climbing.
There was something you brought up earlier, Brian, that this game had no failure states to it, which, thinking on it, that's a pretty interesting design decision. Like, a lot of games would be happy to let you plummet to your doom, cough, cough, Elden Ring, and Dark Souls. But this game doesn't let you do
and
that.
And Tears of the Kingdom.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. What do you think they were going for with that?
I think there's two answers to this. The first is that this is a game that has a particular affect that might put it in the category of the cozy game.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of plummeting to your death does not jive with that vibe. So that, I think, is probably the primary reason why you don't have a plummet to your death failure state in this game. The other is that I think it kind of goes against the story. This is a fable, right? Like, this is a story about a legendary being of myth. The piper, you know, the guy who goes up the tower and plays the pipes. And that guy doesn't fall off a cliff. And he also has hands of steel that allow him to grip ceaselessly to all of the harshest handholds on this gigantic tower.
Oh my goodness, some of those handholds too, like, oh, I'm reaching out 2 feet to have one finger on this guy? Sure, I can stay here forever. Let me just exactly. Shake off my other hand and I'm good to go.
Exactly. I think that's the funniest thing about this is that they, like, treat standing still as, like, a stamina-neutral endeavor. And, like, your guy is in, like, the most goofy, contorted position. He's like, I'm fine. I could be here all day. Don't worry about me.
That is interesting, too. Another thing that, like, feeds into, I'm going to call it the patience. Like, if they had a steadily decreasing stamina meter, or even if they had, like, you can fall off. Well, if they had the decreasing stamina meter, then you're always under the gun when you're climbing, mm-hmm. which yep. might be more realistic, but also not the vibe they were going for. Also not the vibe they were going for was you being able to fall off. You know, like you said, you're the piper. You're not supposed to fall off and go to your doom. But I also think a nice thing that follows on from that is that you feel more free to go and explore things, not thinking like, I'm going to accidentally step off here and I'm going to have to repeat the last 10 minutes of this climb.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. So here's an interesting question for you. Have you heard of a game called Only Up?
Mm-mm.
Okay, so this is like a streamer bait 3D platformer parkour game that is, I guess, popular in streaming communities for basically, I think basically like it's an asset factory platformer where they created basically an 8-hour long obstacle course where the only objective is to get up and there is, or get to the top, only up, it's in the name.
Mm-hmm.
And it has no checkpoints. It is basically like Bennett Foddy's Getting Over It,
mm-hmm.
but a 3D platformer. And yeah, that's like the polar opposite of this game to my mind.
Getting Over It inspired a genre called the Rage Platformer.
I think this absolutely fits in that genre, if that's what we're talking about. So yeah, feel free to look up Only Up if you'd like, but it is not getting a recommendation from me.
When you first mentioned this game, because you beat this game sooner than I did. You were talking about it a little bit. You brought out a comparison to the game Stray, which mm-hmm. seemed weird to me at the time when I was just starting it. But when I continued on in the game in Jusant, noticed that it had the same kind of, I call it this Pathfinder platformer, where you're not trying to navigate an obstacle course. You're rather setting an objective of where you want to go and figuring out the way you need to go towards that. Like, you're not needing precision jumps like you would in a Mario game. You just need to know where you want to go. And like you and me, when we're walking down the hallway to get to, you know, I don't know, store or whatever else, we're going wherever we're going. We're not thinking about, like, where are my feet? You're thinking about, like, what's my objective here? Am I going to the fridge and whatever else? And I feel like both these games simplified movement in a lot of ways because you weren't needing to be like, where am I placing my feet? You're just thinking like, where am I heading to? And I think both of these games did a great job of kind of like having that game feel to them.
Yes, I partially agree with you on that. I think my comparison with Stray is that both of them are heavy on atmosphere. And mm-hmm. while Stray does a lot of the platforming calculations for you, as we talked about, that's a parkour game. It is more focused on, as you said, the destination than how you're getting there and, you know, showing you all the fun things that happen along the way. Jusant is quite focused, from my perspective, on the how, right? Like, you are placing your hands intentionally on your way up the cliff. What I think they have in common is the atmosphere and the care of world building and the care of environment design. And the thing that I like about Jusant is that it's a more mechanically rich version of Stray. You know, I think there's a little more going on in the hands and a little more going on, you know, when I think about how I'm mechanically navigating the space in Jusant than there was in Stray. That's not to say I didn't have a good time with Stray and using the mechanics that were there to navigate that space. I had a great time with that game. Listen to the podcast. But I think this just demanded a little bit more in terms of the thought, the slowing down, and the considering than that game did, perhaps. And that might just be my remove from it. It's been a solid year.
No, I hear you. And yeah, I would say my response is that this game definitely had a really good feel of climbing. Like, you felt like you were climbing in a way I haven't felt in different games. But at the same time, the patience and the forgiving nature of it, it wasn't like another climbing game I used to play called Quap, where if you do not do the right thing, you learn about it very quickly. Not Quap. What was it called? Quap was the track racing game.
Yeah, Quap was the runner or the walker. Was it Quomp?
Quomp? No, the sequel to Quap was like a cliff climbing game.
GURP.
GURP.
A game about climbing a cliff using
yep.
letters.
So GURP, I would say, was another moment-to-moment focused game, but such a different vibe about it. Compared to GURP, Jusant was a bit easier.
Fucking GURP. I've never played GURP, but now I feel like I have to. Since I've said it three times, it's like Beetlejuice. It has manifested itself into my life, and now I'm forced to play GURP.
Now, GURP is the kind of game you play for 2 minutes and rage quit.
Oh. I'd imagine I'll probably do that.